Amen. Okay, we were going over some of these introductory comments about the Beatitudes last week. The usual standards by which men measure happiness. Jesus doesn't even touch them at all in the sermon. They get no mention whatsoever. The Beatitude, of course, is not a biblical word, but that's what we've come to call them. It has this meaning, consummate bliss or happiness, one who is blessed in one way or another. These traits are not either hereditary or the product of one's environment. They are entirely chosen, self-willed. So that we need to make sure we go through that every time we talk, at least through these eight statements, why they are chosen one reason or another. A person chooses to be these things, not that they're not forced upon him. They're not also competing factors. We made kind of a comparison to the gifts of miracles, the spiritual gifts in 1 Corinthians 12. Different saints in the local church had the gifts were spread out, but these, to possess one is to have them all. We have to have all eight traits, if you will, and to lack one is to lack them all. So we must incorporate them onto our character. This is kind of just a quick breakdown of the Beatitudes. Five of them deal with self. Numbers one, and that's not verses, that's numbers, if you number them in order. The first four plus the sixth one. Two of them deal with how we view other people, and only one deal with how the world views us in trying to be a citizen of the heavenly kingdom. All right, this was our last slide we looked at last week. To be poor in spirit is to be spiritually impoverished, to be bankrupt in terms of our spirit, if you will, is to be totally aware of our need for God. And we looked at Luke 16, verses 20 and 21. Poor men they're desperately needy. They know that. They don't have any qualms admitting that. And all they can do is beg. And, of course, these passages that we're using at this particular juncture, they are talking about literal poverty, being literally poor. That passage talks about the rich man and Lazarus. And Lazarus had to be carried to the rich man's gate. All he could do was beg for crumbs. He had no wherewithal to help himself. So that's what we're talking about, this kind of mindset. Now, let's pick up where we left off. The spiritually poor also realize that they've got no right to claim what they've lost. They can't exercise a claim or demand a right to something. In the prodigal son parable, Luke 15, look at that passage real quickly with me. Luke chapter 15, verses 18 through 19. This, of course, is after the prodigal son has come to himself, as Luke writes it. That is in verse 17. When he came to himself and he realized where he was, how far he had gone, he understood, now, my father's got servants, they've got more than I've got, and I'm a son. And they're just slaves. So, verse 18 and 19, basically he realized what? I've got to go back home, but I'm going to have to say something. And there's nothing magical in the phrase, but it's what he understood. What did he realize? Confessed his sin, and what had he forfeited? His right to be the son. I can't claim that anymore. I'm going to have to beg for what? Make me a slave. That's all I can do. And the poor in spirit know that. At one time, when we were innocent, we had fellowship with God. But when we came accountable, if we want to use that phrase, and we chose some sin, or we began to take ourselves away from God, well, that's where we are. Then Jesus invites us back to the kingdom. But can we just come marching right back in like nothing ever happened? No, we've got to beg for mercy. We're poor in spirit. We know we are impoverished and are in great need. So that's what the poor in spirit means. Begging is a hard challenge, isn't it? I don't think any of us have ever had to literally beg for anything. Now, I don't know everybody's situation. I'm not trying to speak for you. I know I've not had to beg for anything. And I'm by no means Bill Gates territory being rich. But by the world standards, I'm pretty well off. In the parable of the unjust steward, look in Luke 16. This is about the crooked steward who was cheating his master and making a pretty good living at it. Excuse me, but he gets caught. He gets found out. Look what he says about himself before he devises his scheme to get out of this. What does he say about himself in verse 3? I can't dig. I'm too weak. My back's too bad to dig. And I've got my pride after all. And I'm too ashamed to beg. But if you want to come to the kingdom, Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. What are you going to have to do? You're going to have to beg. On your knees, on your face. Beg for what? Mercy. Compassion. Forgiveness. God's patience. All those things. Going to have to be some begging. What if you're too proud to beg? Not in the literal sense, but in this sense. Then you're not going to be in the kingdom. That's right, Larson. You're right. You won't be in the kingdom. It's not for you. Your pride's in the way. And then we can go off on a tangent in all kinds of verses about the proud. God resists the proud, but He gives grace to who? To the humble. That's right, to the humble. Okay, so we're only... here's where we get to this now. Jesus says, you're going to really be happy when you realize your poverty. Now again, we'll keep doing this through these eight statements here. How would the world view that kind of statement? What do you mean happiness if you're poor? That's the most miserable people in the world. The happy person is the one who's got all the wealth and all the money. He can live like a king. But see, again, Jesus had said that my kingdom isn't of this world. It doesn't have standards. It doesn't operate on the same level. We must acknowledge and accept this poverty. There's no other way into the kingdom. None whatsoever. Now, I know I keep using literal riches in passages, but look again in Luke 18 now. This is Luke's account. A lot of passage this morning from Luke. But in Luke 18, this is where Luke writes about the rich young ruler. I want to read verses 24 and 25. Ralph, when you have that, will you read that for us? Now, by this time, Jesus has told him what he wanted to hear or what he needed to hear. What he needed to hear, and how did he like it? He didn't care much for it, did he, Mary Ruth? Didn't like it at all. So, that's right. So, 24 and 25, Ralph, now of Luke 18. Now, physically speaking, can a rich man enter the kingdom? He sure can. I know wealthy Christians. Maybe you do too. But that's not the point the Lord's making. If you're a rich man that trusts in your riches like this young man did, then what's easier? You can shove a camel through the eye of a needle before you can have such a man enter this kingdom. That's on the literal sense. Now, what about us and how we're applying this? What if you're rich in that you do not admit your need for God? See, then you cannot, it's going to be impossible. You will not get in this kingdom. It just won't happen. So, if there's no other way, no other way into the kingdom. Right? Where's Bob when you need him? Yeah. Right, the eye of a needle. Well, I think the Lord is meaning a literal needle. Right. Not an opening in a gate. I mean, that may be a good illustration of what we're talking about. I think He means a literal needle and a literal camel. Yes, it is. It's hyperbole. You are right. But it makes an emphatic point. That is literally impossible to shove an animal. I mean, we can sometimes can't get a piece of thread through a needle. So, you know, that's a whole lot smaller than a camel. That's right. If he's like this man, if he's like the rich young ruler who trusted in his riches, he will not see heaven. It won't happen. He's got to give that up and admit his poverty. I think that's the point that he's making. What next two verses? In Luke 18? Yes. Who then can be saved? And Jesus said, well, with God. Right. 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 But with God, God can remove that if man will come to God and admit his poverty, admit his need for God, and be poor in spirit. So remember, this is a chosen poverty. We choose it. We bring it on ourselves. It doesn't come to us through hard knocks in life. That's not what we're... This is chosen. We agree to be this kind of person. It's an awareness of being destitute. In Luke 18 and verse 13, the parable of the publican and the Pharisee, they went up to the house to pray, and the publican looked down with disdain down his nose. I thank thee, Lord. I mean, it wasn't really a prayer. It was kind of like a resume, wasn't it? I'm not like this and that, or even this silly old publican. But what did the publican do, or the tax collector? Well, first off, what wouldn't he do? He wouldn't even lift his eyes up to heaven. I'm not even fit to, if I could see the throne, I'm not even fit to do it. But then what did he do? He beat his breast, and his only statement was what? Begged for mercy. See, that's it. He begged for mercy. He didn't say, I've done all this bad stuff. The poor man knows that God knows what. He already knows what I've done. I don't have to sit here and tell him what I've done or not done. So we have to be aware of being destitute. And it's also an awareness that there's no other way to correct this. The way of man is not in himself. It's not in man who walks to direct his own steps. We cannot go out here and earn enough spiritual points to get out of our poverty. You can cure physical poverty by working hard and living in America, and you can cure that, but it won't happen here. Not this kind of poverty. We've got to beg for mercy. We've got to beg for pardon. Now, this gets us to, this is on page 5 now, question number 8. What do we know what sin pays? Romans 6:23 says what? The wages of sin, the wages are death. You get what you deserve. But the free gift of God, Paul says, is eternal life. So sin has made us poor. Absolutely. And in Matthew 18, I'm doing a lot of skipping around here, I know, but these are all passages that I think you're pretty much familiar with. Another parable, Matthew 18, the parable of the two debtors. Matthew 18, 23 through 27 is what we want. The unforgiving servant is how some would title this parable. The first servant who we're going to focus on here, how much did he owe the king? 10,000 talents. Who knows how much a talent is? Of course, a talent in the Bible would not be an ability, it's a unit of money. How much was a talent? Okay, about 6,000 denarii. Now, how much was one denarii? Or one denarius is one day's wage. So 6,000 days' wages. If you do the quick math in your head, that may work out to be about 10, 12, 15 years. And he owed, and that's just one talent. He owed 10,000 of them. For one talent? All right. 10,000 of them. So, let's work out the repayment schedule on that. What about it? You don't have enough lifetimes to pay that back. And that's the point he's saying. See, we cannot pay this back. And this particular servant is put in comparison to the second servant. What did he owe? No, he owed more than that. 100 denarii. 100 days' wages. About a third of a year. All right? Now, let's say that you owed somebody whatever you make a year. Let's say this. Well, you owe a third of your yearly salary. Well, that'd be hard to pay back, wouldn't it? You have to make some drastic cuts, but what? You could do it. It might take you a long time, but you could pay it back. And the point is, where was the mercy on both sides of these issues? What about the king who was owed 10,000 talents? Look, the Bible, Jesus says he looked with compassion. He felt compassion upon this servant. Did both servants beg the same thing? They both said, have patience with me, and I will pay it back. But what did the first servant fail to realize? You can't pay this back. It's not going to happen. And we cannot pay this debt back. It won't happen. So we just might as well admit that we're poor, we're bankrupt, And our only recourse is to fall on our face and beg for mercy. That's our only hope. And pray God forgive us. And Jesus says, if you do that, you're a poor in spirit. What's your reward? Reward's the bad word to use. What's your blessing? You'll have the kingdom of heaven. A poor man will, and notice the terms, the poor man will have a kingdom. You'll be rich. You'll have a future, if you will. So the poor can have such a kingdom. They can be rich. I'm going to look at these passages real quickly. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9, when Paul is talking in the context there about the collection for the needy saints in the first century, of course that was dealing with actual money. He says in verse 8, 2 Corinthians 8, I speak not by commandment, but I am testing the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though He was rich, yet for your sakes He became poor. Why? That you through His poverty might be made rich. We can be rich. And in Luke 12:21, Jesus, one more parable to look at real quickly, the parable of the rich farmer. Of course, this just makes a statement at the end of it, and I'm just kind of using the reverse of this. The farmer had such an attitude or a disposition about himself, he was laying up treasure for himself. And Jesus says he's such a person as what? He's not rich toward God. I think that means that one can be rich toward God. He just wasn't, but you can be rich toward God. But to be rich toward God, what must you first do? You first must choose to be poor. You must embrace this spiritual poverty. And so happy or blessed is he that does that. Is that a challenge? To everybody. It most certainly is. But it's something that we must do if we want to be rich. So question 9 is the blessing for the one who is spiritually impoverished. He will have a kingdom. All right. Now that's just one verse, but see how much is in there. There's just so much in this sermon. Really is a lot. All right. The second beatitude is the mournful. Blessed is he that mourns. So, question 10, what type of mourning do you think is under consideration? All right. Yes, many think that, as we said last week, I've heard this used at funerals, and certainly we want to be a people that comforts others in their sadness. Well, I don't think, in fact, I'm convinced Jesus is not talking about that here. That doesn't fit the context of the kingdom, whether it's physical sadness, death, or some tragedy come upon a person or his or her family, and it really just blows everything apart. That sorrow is necessary. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that. Physical sadness, whether it's death or some illness or some tragedy that may result in death, that is a indiscriminate or necessary sorrow. Ecclesiastes 7, the wise man said, it's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. Why? Well, because that is the end of every man, and the living take it to heart. They are made wiser by that. Now, why is that necessary? Hebrews 9:27. We all face that. That's right. You can't escape that except for one way, and that's if the Lord comes first. But if He doesn't come before you leave this world, then, or your family, your loved ones leave this world, then you'll face it. And you will be sad. Whether you want it or not, it'll come your way. Right. Yes, it does. That's correct. So what we're talking about is a chosen sorrow. It's one that's sought after. And again, this flies right in the face of human wisdom. What do you mean to be happy? You've got to be sad. That makes no sense. Well, in the level of human wisdom, it doesn't make any sense. But Jesus is operating on a higher plane than that. And we need to understand what He's talking about here. So the mournful, the world says happiness is gained if we can avoid tears, be removed from sad situations, that's when you're truly happy. Jesus teaches us otherwise. The happiness here is what? If you're this sorrow, or if you're this sorrowful or sorry, you'll receive comfort. Well, comfort in what situation? Comfort in what way? That's what we want to make sure we understand here. The kingdom citizen has found comfort in what? God's forgiven him. God forgave him. God has forgiven him. He's extended him mercy and pardon. Again, it's for sin. The right-thinking person will shed these tears because down deep he knows, what has he done? He has sinned. Well, it's not a big deal, I've sinned. So I told a lie. So I shaved a few numbers off my tax return. So I took something from the store without paying for it. Everybody does it, big deal. Well, but what does sin do? It does, but does sin do anything to God? Sometimes I think we don't think about that. Yeah, Genesis 6, when the world was so wicked, all right, it says that man could only, he did evil continually in his thoughts and his deeds, that he just was one mess. And Moses writes that God was grieved in his heart to the point that he regretted what? That I even went through this process and that I even made man. See, if we get to where we no longer think about what we do, what we say, how we act, how we dress, whatever, if we forget, now if I do this, I wonder how this is going to affect God. I wonder what God thinks about this. If we don't ever give that any thought, then how likely are we to go ahead and do stuff like that? We'll do it. We'll do it. If we don't stop and think, well, I know God said not to do that. I know the Bible says no, but I'm just going to forget about that. I'm not going to think about that. That's not in my thoughts at all. But on the other hand, if we say, you know, I know God said don't do this, but now I'm concerned about how I'm going to treat Him. How will God feel about my actions if I do this? And until we come to the point where we shed tears because we've sinned against God, we won't be comforted. But if we do that, Jesus said, you'll be happy, you'll be blessed, because your Father will bring you comfort. And that comfort is found in mercy and pardon, forgiveness. So that's the kind of mourning Jesus is talking about. This is taught in prophecy. This is not just a statement that's found here in Matthew 5. Turn to Isaiah 61. Perhaps your Bible has a reference to this, just trying to find a prophetic parallel, if you will. Isaiah 61. Larson, when you have that, read the first three verses for us, please, of Isaiah 61. Now, turn to Luke chapter 4. You can find a similar verse there in Ezekiel 9. We won't read that, but that's just for reference purposes. A similar statement spoken to the remnant in captivity by Ezekiel. But in Luke 4, starting in verse 16, Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. He was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written. And what does he read? What Larson just wrote, Isaiah 61. Okay? Now, verse 20. When he closed the book, he gave it back to the attendant, sat down. The eyes of all who were in the synagogue were upon him, and what did he say? This has been fulfilled today in your hearing or in your presence. What was he saying by that statement? What does he mean, today this has been fulfilled? That's right. And he's talking about what he was offering in terms of his preaching for the kingdom. I've come to bring comfort. I've come to bring peace, if you will, to those that mourn over their sins. And that continues to be so ever since the day the kingdom has been established. So this is, again, this is not new to the gospel. This was taught in prophecy. And Jesus referred to it when he read. As Brett said a moment ago, this is godly sorrow. We're talking about the right kind of sorrow. Can a person have the wrong kind of sorrow? Well, he can. And I think Paul mentions that. Look in 2 Corinthians 7. This is a passage that you've heard numerous times, I know. But Paul makes reference to his first letter in this place, 2 Corinthians 7. If you had to use some quick statements, how would you characterize the first letter? It was a reprimand. It was, at times, it was very fatherly and gentle, but other times it was pretty stern. Paul really had to get on those people for all the various problems that were just running rampant through the church at Corinth. Well, now Paul talks about that first letter. Look with me at verses 8 through 10. Shirley, if you have that, would you read, please, 2 Corinthians 7, 8 through 10. Okay, thank you. Now, verse 10 particularly, he mentions two kinds of sorrow. There's worldly sorrow, and then there's godly sorrow. Now, what's worldly sorrow? You're sorry. You guys got caught. And I wish I hadn't done that. Boy, it's bad. But that's not, there's no contrition there. You just, if you hadn't got caught, let's put it this way, if you hadn't got caught, then would you be sorry? No, wouldn't be sorry. You'd say, I get away with that. Let's go do something else now. But godly sorrow, whether you get caught or not, what does it lead to? I'm sorry. What does it produce? Verse 10. Repentance, and that leads to salvation. Repentance, what is that all about? Yeah, you're sorry enough to do what? I'm going to stop this. Well, you're wrong, and you also know you're doing what to God? You're hurting Him, you're grieving Him, you're causing Him anguish. Again, back to Genesis 6. Yes, you're in all those things. You're insulting Him. You're just rubbing your thumb and your nose at Him. I mean, you're doing all those things to God. And so this is godly sorrow Jesus is talking about. Not the sadness that comes upon you from the world because these external things happen. Again, what kind of sorrow is this? This is a chosen sorrow. This is the sorrow that you embrace. And we've got to get our minds out of this word if we're going to say, yeah, I want that kind of sorrow. Well, to be a citizen kingdom, to be a citizen in the kingdom, that's what we're going to have to do. Yes. That's right. That's in verse 8. You know, I really hated to have to write that, but I had to. So I regret having to do it, but I'm not sad that I did it. It's necessary. Yes, yes. All these things come into play. You are correct. So God is full of mercy. What will God eventually do with all tears? He'll wipe them away. Revelation 21, verse 4. Now that would be all tears. Tears that are shed because of from indiscriminate sorrow, pain and death, and that's true. But what about these kinds of tears too? Yes, those will eventually all be wiped away. That's what He offers you in this kingdom. But to come into the kingdom, you're going to have to admit that I've really messed it up. And I'm truly, truly sorrowful or sorry. So Jesus said, blessed are the mournful. And that is the blessing that waits for them. Question 13 is that they will be comforted. They'll be the ones that receive the actual comfort. When He chooses to cry this way, He receives comfort for his sorrows. It's God's mercy and God's forgiveness. All right. Anything else on the mournful you can think of? All right. Let's talk now about the third one. Back down to Matthew 5. This is, he says, blessed are the meek. Some versions may say gentle. Blessed are the gentle, the meek. What's their happiness, as he says? They will inherit the earth. And we'll talk about that in a moment. That can be, and is often, greatly misunderstood. But we'll hammer out the meek part first. This may be possibly the most misunderstood trait. And not just in the context of the sermon, but just meekness in general. What does the world think of meekness? Milk toasty, that's right, just pitiful. Little old scrawny thing. You're just a bug on the windshield. You're a doormat, you're gonna get run over, you're just in the way, those kinds of things. This is not weakness in where you allow others to abuse you and walk over you and all that kind of business. The world says you're inferior, you're a failure. Stand up for yourself, defend yourself, don't let people run over you like that. Meekness, it will not get you anywhere in the world. You'll be a flop. You won't be a success. Well, meekness, I like to refer to it as the strength under control. There's strength, but it's been restrained for one reason or another. That's meekness. It is the resolve to refrain from exercising power in given situations when you might be so inclined to do so. That's what meekness is. Yes, Rob. Yes. Absolutely. Those passages right there, you're right on point. In the garden, when Peter got the sword out, and what did he do with Malchus's ear? All right, now there's that. Now let's have it out here. We'll fight to the death. And what did Jesus say? First thing to Peter, put the sword away. We're not going to have it that way. Yes. And then he said to Peter, as if to say, now Peter, you're not thinking about this. Don't you know who I am? Or do you not know that what can happen just like that? That I have at my disposal 12 legions of angels. My Father can send them right now. I don't need a little sword. I don't need that. I've often thought this to me is really compelling. How many is in a legion? 6,000 in a legion, so 72,000 angels. What could one angel do? 183 or 185,000 Assyrians. One angel did that. What do you think 72,000 angels could do? My mind can't grasp that. That's just the power at the disposal of the Lord. So he may have been inclined to defend himself against the assault brought on him by men, but as Ralph says in his Great Invitation, come to me. I am meek and lowly in heart. I'm what meekness is. Now that's a divine being saying that. Someone says, well, I can't do that. I'm not God. Well, let's look at a human. All right. He wasn't divine. What about Moses? What does Numbers 12 verse 3 say? Meekest man on the earth. When anybody ever meeker than him, except the Lord, but I mean human wise. Now, it's interesting, what was the context of Numbers 12 when that was said about Moses? What was going on? Do you remember? All right, his own siblings were griping to the Lord about Moses. Now, he gives us the reason in the text. What was their complaint? What had he done that they didn't like, obviously? He married that Cushite woman. But that wasn't what they complained about. What did they say? Moses, you're taking too much. You're a glory hog here. And you're getting all the glory for yourself, all the credit. Has not God also spoken by or through us? Or to us? So you need to back off here, Moses, and you're taking on way more than you deserve. Well, when Moses was reproached that way, in this case, this had to be very hurtful, his own family doing this. What did Moses say? What did he do? He didn't do anything. See, that's what meekness is. Meekness is the resolve of the mind that when you're being threatened, when you're being maligned, persecuted, reproached, whatever, I'm not too concerned about that. I didn't put this in the material. Hope I can find it right quick. It's in Romans 8. Turn there real quickly. That thought just jumped in my head. Romans chapter 8. And I want to look at verse 33. Paul asked the question, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? See, who's going to say these slander, like Moses went through, like these slanderous things against you? Who can bring, and I think what is meant here in the Greek, who can successfully bring the charge and have it stick? Well, what does the next statement say? Man may charge you. What's God done? He's justified. And that word justified means you're innocent. Man says you're guilty. I'm charging you with such and so, but it's God that justifies. So, if men say all kinds of things about you that aren't true, and I know it's going to hurt, but in the final analysis of the thing, what does it mean? It don't mean nothing. And so that's why Moses could say, you know, to my siblings oftentimes say, you know, they get in these fights and bickering back and forth. Moses, he didn't respond to it. He didn't say a word to them. He let that go. But meekness is not either, is or neither is it, an indifference to evil. The meek person is not passive. Again, back to Moses. If he was reproached, he didn't say a word. But if the people did something to God, what about Moses? Well, you better get out of his way. Yeah, absolutely. Two times. You're right. Not just once, but twice. And in Exodus 32, 19 and 20, the golden calf story, Moses broke those tablets in righteous indignation, took that calf, burned it, ground it up into powder. Drink this. You want to be so full of your calf, you're going to have it. So meekness, and also meekness also does not say to those that need to be wiped out, yeah, blast them, let them have it. What did Moses do? He begged God to pardon them. It's not indifference to evil. So the meek man knows. I'm not too concerned if I get knocked around here, but don't do it to God. I'm deeply concerned about that. And that must not allow be allowed to happen. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. Job realized he had spoken foolishly on those ideas. You are correct. So, this is not inborn. I've often made the point, all of us are born with what disposition? Selfish. Babies cry, they want to be fed, changed. I want attention right now. You're not listening to me, you're not watching me, I've got needs here. We're all selfish to the core when we're born. And these are traits that we have to learn. We have to choose to be a meek person, willingly learned and possessed. And so you can see it goes against the grain, the next set of questions, particularly question 15 and then also on top of page 6, question 16. This goes flies right in the face of pride, self-assertiveness. And I'm all for being an assertive person, but it's up to a point. It's not about me. I don't think anybody has a right to beat my wife or my children. I'll defend them, but what if it's for faith? What if we're persecuted because we're members of the kingdom? The Lord addresses that in this sermon. That's right. We have to take that. We cannot avenge ourselves. So the meek is, we're talking about the focusing on self, being concerned about me and how I'm being hurt or whatever, that only brings disaster. Meekness is the answer to all this. Self must be denied for a higher purpose. And this has been illustrated in several ways with passages that we'll see just in a moment. It's not passiveness toward evil, as we said. It's not weakness. It's humble strength. It's not weak shyness. And the world says the meek, they're just, you know, little scrawled up, little pitiful people, and they don't have any self-esteem, and they don't have any assertiveness, and they don't have any goals or ambition. They're just like paper that the wind can blow this way and blow that way. They're just nothing to them. That's not it. It's humble strength. Strength under control is what meekness is. All right. Again, it was mentioned with Moses a few minutes ago. Meek man is more concerned about abuse directed toward God than those that are hurled toward himself. He'll just bypass that. Moses did that, showed us the way toward that kind of thinking. All right. These are the passages now, top of page 6, question 5. I thought it was good for us to think about these real quickly. Turn to Philippians 2. These four passages are well known. They just address some basic points, if you will, that need to be found in the life of the Christian. Jesus serving lost men. Read verses 6 and 7, Angela, please, when you have that in Philippians 2. Jesus equal with the Father? In one way, he is. Now, he's not the Father. No, he's the Son. But he is equal with the Father in that he is every bit as much divine as the Father is. So whatever traits it is that makes the Father deity or divine, Jesus has those. But Paul says, Jesus did not regard his equality with God a thing to be, most versions say grasped, but it really means held on to. It's as if the idea is, the Father says to the Son, I have got a job for you. I need to send you to earth. You need to go down there and die for man so that he can be saved. And Jesus is the temperamental little son that grabs on, no, I don't want to go. I'm holding on to my station right here. You can't make me go. That wasn't Jesus at all. He didn't see his deity as a thing to be held on to keep him where he was. Where was he? He was in heaven. He had to leave that. He laid those privileges aside, came down here, and humbled himself even to what point Paul says. Not just death, but emphasis. Even the death of the cross. The worst kind of death. That's right. The one reserved for criminals. So, no, he didn't. He didn't stop being divine. You're right. But he laid that privilege aside. The privilege of being at the right hand of the Father, being enthroned as the Christ. He was the Christ here on earth too, but he wasn't enthroned. He was walking among men. So Jesus shows us that, you know, you serve others and you still maintain your identity, you still maintain your connection to the Father, if you will, and that's meekness. It's a great illustration of what meekness is. Hebrews chapter 5, look with me at verses 8 and 9. Another well-known passage. Jesus experienced complete obedience. Now, most versions say, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Now, the idea of Jesus learning something can be taken too far to mean what? I didn't know anything about obedience. I was just clueless about that. That doesn't describe a son of God. Jesus didn't need to be taught anything. Well, or maybe experience. Had Jesus ever experienced death before? He hadn't been through that. And so, going through that on behalf of man, he learned obedience. He experienced it fully. And having been perfected, or having then been perfected, verse 9, what was the result of that? He became the author or the source of salvation to all them that obey him. That's right. Absolutely. Right. He always knew. He always knew the importance of obedience. But this passage emphasizes to what extent he went, and the ultimate extent would be he allowed himself to be killed, murdered, crucified. And in that way, he learned obedience. Now, that's about the Son of God. What about you and I? Romans 12:19, great passage. It's so easy when you're wrong, and you can see where some of these questions are going. with respect to meekness, as we said on a previous chart, when man may be so inclined to defend self, I've been wronged, been done dirty, and I'm going to get him back. And it won't be even. I'm going to really get him. Make sure that I get my pound of flesh, as Shakespeare would say. Well, what does Paul say in Romans 12, verse 19? Avenge not yourselves, and I like the way the New American Standard reads, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, or he said, then what? Vengeance is, it's not yours, it's mine. Okay. So, man has to leave room for the wrath of God. Now, for a man to do that, let's take two men up here. We'll put them on both sides of the aisle up here. They've both been done wrong. They've both been done dirty. This one lives by the code of the world. And so, he's going to scheme up and devise all kinds of things. I'm going to make this guy pay that did me wrong. I'm going to get him. All right. This one over here, he's a kingdom citizen. And he's been done wrong too. He feels hurt. He feels insulted. But he knows the power of meekness. And what does he do? See, he refrains from that urge and that temptation. And so I'm just, not only, he would do this, not only am I not going to go hunt the guy down and get him back, but I'm going to do what for him? I'm going to pray for him. Maybe I can teach him. He can come into the kingdom too. Someone says, well, now wait a minute, you weak little thing. He may get through the rest of his life and he'll never have to pay for that. What's the meek man say? No, because my father tells me, leave room for him. He'll take care of it. He'll answer for it one day. I'm not the judge, jury, and executioner, though. I'm going to let that go. God will deal with it. But while he's here living, maybe I can reach him with the gospel. Now see, the world says, oh, that's the real man over there. And this is the, you know, he's just nobody. He's pitiful. But in reality, who's the stronger? This man's the stronger one right here. He knows where it's at. This one over here lives by the code of the jungle. And that'll get you nowhere. Nowhere at all. Yes, sir. Yes. Let him deal with it. Yes, he is. Absolutely. Okay, and then the last one here is man must clothe himself with humility. I want to make one grammatical point about 1 Peter 5, verses 5 and 6. And again, I think it is not every version reads this way. I think it's the New American Standard. I'm using the New King James right now. But in 1 Peter 5, I may have that backwards. Let me look at it right here, right quick. But I can never get over there. Verse 5, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive. But the American Standard says, clothe yourselves with humility. Now, in the Greek, that's in what's called the middle voice, that verb clothe. And what does that mean? Well, you have three voices in Greek. You have active, passive, and middle. Right? Active is where you're doing the acting. I kick the ball. Okay, that's an active verb. Well, passive voice is when the action is done to you. You're the object of the action. The ball hit me. Middle voice is kind of a hybrid. It's when you do it to yourself. All right? So when Peter says, clothe yourself, see, that's why this is chosen. No one can force meekness on you, like having to eat your turnips. You eat those, you're not leaving the table. You have to do that. No, you can't make somebody be meek. You choose to do it. I'm putting this on myself. Clothing myself with humility. So Jesus says, that is for a person to do that to him or herself, that is the strong one. That is the dedicated and committed person. And he knows where it's at. He knows where the power is. It's not in himself, but it's in God. So that is the meek man, if you will. The last question on meek section. The blessing, Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now someone says, what does that mean, to inherit the earth? Well, what does that mean? Well, first off, what doesn't it mean? Okay, we know it can't mean the planet because why? It's destined for a burning. So it'll be heaven to inherit. So then what is the earth to be inherited? Blessings? Physical needs? Okay. Anything else? A dwelling place? Anybody else? I think that's what it is, Lars. I think it's the new heavens and new earth. 2 Peter 3, we know he said, but we said we look for a new heavens and a new earth. That's continuing in the same context of 2 Peter 3, 7 and 10 through 12. But we look for a new heavens. Well, that's prophetic also. That means a new order of things. There will not be a literally new earth when the Lord comes, because there'll be no need for it. But it'll be a new system, if you will, a new order of things, and that's what we'll inherit, not a physical planet. And so we understand that to mean the world says if you're meek, as we understand meekness, you get nothing. You just get run over. You get your last in the line, and it's all gone. When you get up there to get your part of it, and you have nothing. No, Jesus says you have an inheritance. You have a future. When you bring this meekness, this strength under control kind of thinking upon yourself, that is the truly happy person. That is the blessed person. And the world scoffs at that idea, but that is the truth. And the longer you and I live, you know, we realize that is right. That is true. Yes, Mary Ruth. Well. Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that's a good point. The premillennial doctrine will say there's going to be this earth future, and so if folks don't even believe in heaven or hell or hereafter or, you know, eternal things, then I think that's a good observation to make, that this makes no sense to them. But to understand the overall teaching of the Scripture about eternity and those kinds of important biblical concepts, I think this has to be to me, this is the most plausible way to understand this phrase, you'll inherit the earth. You have a spiritual future. Yes, Bill. Yes. Yeah. Well, you may have the right to do something. And Paul talked about that too. That's right. You are correct. Sometimes rights can be given up for the cause of the greater good. I think that's a good point to make. Yes, Andrew. Yes. We had a cute little song we taught our kids when they were small. It was Joy. Jesus, others, and then yourself. Yourself goes last. You serve yourself last. So you'll never have a better day, as Paul Earnhardt said in a recent meeting, when you think of others before yourself. You just lose yourself, deny yourself. That's the best day you'll ever have, doing the work of the kingdom and trying to help other people in one way or another. Yes, Ralph. You seem rather thoughtful over there. Go ahead and read that for us. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 8. Yes, absolutely. Okay, we have time to start. We won't get this one finished, but we can at least start verse 6. Now, this is the fourth of the eight, so we're about halfway through. Jesus said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. There's a lot in that one too. Question 18, what does it mean to be hungry? I've got a passage cited for that. And also thirsty. What does it mean? Okay, it's getting close to 11 o'clock, and maybe your belly's starting to rumble. Depending on when you had breakfast, that might not be the way. But we're talking about very deep needs, and I'm emphasizing the word deep. In Matthew 4 and verse 2, who was it talking about there? Jesus. What is about to happen? His temptations. What was the first one? If thou be the Son of God, command these stones to become bread. Well, somebody says, well, big deal. What was the big deal about it? 40 days. he had not eaten. And this is, in the Greek, it's the same word hunger there as in Matthew 5, verse 6. So someone said, you know, I'm kind of hungry. Well, but have you ever been that hungry? No, haven't been. Likewise, the word thirst in John 19, 28, Jesus is on the cross. And what may be one of his last statements, what does he say? Two words. I thirst. Now, why would Jesus be thirsty in that situation? Crucifixion was a cruel way. You lose a lot of bodily fluids. That is true. The body's in shock or trauma under great duress or stress. And so Jesus says, I thirst. Again, it's the same word in the Greek as Matthew 5, verse 6, when he says, blessed are the hungry and the thirsty. We're talking about deep needs. Now, I know you and I have used, you know, we've used these words about ourselves before. I've used them. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. But not like this. We've never had this critical a need, what Jesus is talking about here. Haven't felt it. I know I haven't. Maybe you have. I don't know. I know I have not. Again, this is a chosen way to think. I choose to be this hungry. I choose to be this thirsty. Someone says, well, why in the world would you do that? Well, that will come out in our discussion here. The knowledge, I think what he's discussing is the knowledge and awareness of our own emptiness. We're empty. And we have a great desire to be filled. We want to be full with the food and the drink that we need. Angela mentioned longing or craving. If I kind of combine both definitions for the word hungry and thirsty. Thayer says it means to long for, crave, or to eagerly desire. So there's great longing or yearning here. It's not just, oh yeah, I like to eat a little bit, I'm kind of hungry. No, this is deep needs, critical needs. Righteousness, hunger and thirst for what? What does righteousness mean? Thayer defines righteousness this way. It is to have a right relationship with God. It's the desire to be like God. The righteous person is the one who is as he ought to be. He's the right kind of person. In his thinking, in his feeling, and in his acting, his whole sense of being, he's the right kind of person. See? So what does that say to the person who on the outside looks like he's doing the right thing, but on the inside his thoughts are elsewhere? He's not righteous then. What is it? He's a hypocrite. That's right. He's just play acting. He's just pretending. And that can fool a man, but God's not fooled by any of that. So that's what we have to hunger and thirst for, is righteousness. Now, many try to fill themselves with things that aren't as eternal as they are. We'll probably have to close with this. Go back to Ecclesiastes, and then we'll end our class. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, starting in verse 10. Men try to fill themselves with wealth. All right, well, what about that? He who loves silver, what's the problem? He won't be satisfied. Why not, Freddie? Why won't he be satisfied with silver if that's what he loves? Never going to get enough. You'll never get full. He will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? Chapter 6 and verse 7, the same thing. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. We're just pumping it down an endless hole, and it never fills up. The more we do it, the more we shove in there, and it will never work. Let's finish this chart out here. Even though it is desired, we want it, we crave for it, it will miserably fail. Why? Look in chapter 3. We'll go to the Luke 15 passage in a moment, but look in Ecclesiastes 3, verses 9 through 11. Even the most unrighteous among us, I don't care who you are or what you do, even the most unrighteous among us fall under what this passage teaches. Ecclesiastes 3, starting in verse 9. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in His time. That's what God has done. The next statement. What has God also done? He has put eternity in their hearts. We are eternal beings. And even the most thoughtless, godless, stupid man will ask questions like, why am I here? Where am I going? Those kinds of questions. Why? Because deep within him, there's this eternal yearning. And he tries to fill that with things of this world, won't he? And what's the problem? Won't happen. It will not fill him. He'll be empty all his life. Final passage, Luke 15, again, back to the parable of the prodigal son. Notice what it says, or I think if it doesn't say it, it strongly implies it. Luke 15, 16 to 17. He's in the hog pen out there in the world. And what is he desiring? He's feeding the pods or the slop to the hogs, and he says, well, that looks pretty good. Now, why did it look good to him? Because he was hungry. He didn't have anything. But he realized, that's not going to fill me up. Verse 17, when he came to himself, and back home, what do the servants have? They've got bread. I'm hearing this out here in this filth. And I'm perishing with hunger. We've got to realize that we try to fill ourselves with things, we greatly desire them, but in the end, they will not fill us. Yes. Of what chapter? Oh, okay. Oh, because he wanted to be fed? Well, okay. All right. Okay. Well, let's try, if you're agreeable to this, let's try to meet for an hour and a half next Tuesday. Now, if you can't stay, I understand you've got something to do, but we need to get some extra time, so I want to meet till 11:30 next Tuesday, and just bear with me if you can. If you can't, if nobody wants to, then okay, I'm going to stay here alone, but if you can stay next half an hour, I'd appreciate it next week. Thank you for your good comments today and your attendance. I appreciate it.